Thursday, April 7th, 2016. The time is 3:30 p.m. We are here in Juneau in the Capitol Building. Committee members present today, Senator Stedman, Senator Michicki, Senator Coghill, and myself, Senator Giesel. Senator Costello, I know, is tied up in Labor and Commerce Committee meeting, and I'm expecting Senator Wilkowski and Senator Stoltz soon. Let's see, recording secretary is Ann. On the audio today is Cody. Thank you to both of you for getting us going today. So today the committee is taking up Senate Bill 130 again. We're going to hear from utilities today as well as the RCA before we go back to the Department of Revenue for more fiscal numbers. So we're going to start out with NSTAR Natural Gas, and then that will be followed by the RCA and then Matanuska Electric Association. So first off, welcome to Mr. Jared Green, President of NSTAR, and Moira Smith, Senior Vice President and General Counsel to NSTAR. Welcome. If you would put yourself on the record, and you have a nice PowerPoint to take us through.
Perfect. Good afternoon, Chair Giesel, members of the committee. I am Jared Green, President of NSTAR, and with me, as you said, is Moira Smith, Vice President and General Counsel. We thank you very much for allowing us the time to speak today. NSTAR is here today as the largest purchaser of natural gas in the Cook Inlet. Ultimately, our customers are a beneficiary of the tax credit program that has been in place since 2012. Our customers depend on natural gas from the Cook Inlet to heat their homes, their businesses, our schools, our hospitals, and our industries. Fundamentally, our interest is in fostering a stable and appealing natural gas environment in the Cook Inlet. This environment needs to exist in the short term, the medium term, and in the long term. At NSTAR, our number one priority is safe, reliable service to our natural gas customers. We were founded in 1959, the same year as statehood. On average, our customers use about 33 billion cubic feet of natural gas. That does vary, though. When we have winters like what we had this last winter and the winter before, where it's fairly warm, our customers can burn as little as about 30 BCF of gas. We can also have winters like what we had in 2012, where it was closer to 35 BCF of gas. So these are NSTAR's direct customers and doesn't include the load for the power corporations. They would be separate on that end. As a bit of a comparison, our understanding overall production coming out of the Cook Inlet, it's about 80 BCF a year right now. So we're pretty close to half of the overall gas used. NSTAR has very high seasonality within our gas needs as well. Moira will go through this in a little bit more detail with a few pictures on it as well. But from a very high level, we have about a 12-to-1 ratio of winter to summer gas. So our customers will burn 12 times more gas in the wintertime than what they do in the summer. The final aspect for setting the stage is our daily variability. We live in an environment where we do have substantial variability due to the weather. With the current customer base that we have a potential daily demand of 287 million cubic feet of gas per day. This level of demand is most likely to occur in January of any given year. But, depending on weather, that same January day could also be under 100 million cubic feet a day. So we could, on any given winter day, be up at 287, or we could be under 100 as well. So there is a fair deliverability variability. When NSTAR plans this natural gas portfolio, we look many years in advance. We operate in a closed supply network in the Cook Inlet, and with that we need very long lead times. We need to know that we have firm gas lined up and in place for our customers at least 2 years in advance. Anything less than that does put our customers at risk of supply shortages. In NSTAR's business, we must have gas available for our customers on the coldest days, no matter what. When it is 20 degrees below in January and it's dark out, every single one of our 141,000 customers must have their gas needs met. And just to put that customer count in context, that represents over half of the population of Alaska as well. So you end up having between 2 and 3 people per household. So what does this mean to be a natural gas supplier to NSTAR? There's no doubt it is challenging to supply natural gas in the Cook Inlet today. And, as I noted, NSTAR has very, very high needs, and we're very demanding on it. Between the SINGSA storage facility and our producer contracts, we need to have that 287 million per day of gas available. However, we do not need it each and every day. So for producers in the inlet, between the producers and SINGSA, we have to have significant capacity available beyond what the average gas production is. It means producers need to have the operational capability to ramp up production, but also the capability to throttle it back when it's not needed. This is a very, very different world than what the lower 48 has. With the integrated transmission and storage network, producers down south, they can simply drill a well, they open up their taps 100%, and they produce it. The large market simply absorbs the gas. From a utility perspective, it's also a very nice, easy world down there. Utilities will have a lineup of marketers who are trying to sell them gas from various places and locations. As well, if a contract that a utility has is not fulfilled, they simply go back to their marketing stream or screen and source that gas from any one of 1,000 other producers who are willing and able to supply them gas. We do not have that luxury here. We have a very small and illiquid marketplace. We have a handful of buyers and even a smaller number of suppliers. Layer on that, the fact that Conoco is selling its assets, this will take another supplier out of the marketplace, and with MLMP being a purchaser of that, it does shrink the overall buying side as well, with MLP effectively becoming self-supplied. So this leaves us with a very delicate marketplace. And I don't want to come across that the sky is falling here. We are in a much better place than what we were in 2012. We have transitioned from a time where we were looking at shortages, both from a total supply and from a deliverability perspective. Today, Moira Ray is going to talk to you about a contract that NSTAR has signed with Hillcorp. It is a very key foundation to NSTAR's natural gas portfolio. This contract will take us out through 2023, which, from NSTAR's perspective, that takes us just beyond what I would consider the short term of what we look at. So we will have a good portion of our gas contracted out through 2023. This contract is in front of the RCA right now for approval. The RCA has been asking a number of really good questions about the contract, and I know that the committee will be able to speak to Chairman Pickett afterwards. Right now, we're in a position where I feel I have fairly good visibility out through about 2021 as to where our gas needs are going to come from. With continued activity by Hillcorp and by Fury, along with hopeful growth and hopeful stability from Kirkland Energy and from AIX, and also hopefully new players. With Bluecrest's hopeful development of their gas, and again as well, hopefully there will be other players that are coming into the marketplace. I am optimistic that we can see our supply horizon moving out into the 2025s. However, the statement I just made, it hinges on the continued activity by these and new producers. We need to make sure we're encouraging and fostering an environment which keeps the producers engaged. Now, I feel strongly that the utilities in the inlet have a very large responsibility for this. And at NSTAR, we have designed our gas supply portfolio to balance our number one priority of safe, reliable natural gas service with the need to foster the long-term viability of the inlet. We have put our support behind Fury's development of their kitchen light unit. We have we've signed a three-year contract with Fury, which is a core underpinning to their development. And that contract as well is filed and in front of the RCA, and they're doing their diligence around that review. But with that, we have also left open about 10% of our supply portfolio for other producers to be able to come in. Since 2012, the state has provided a huge support to the viability of the gas supply in the Cook Inlet. And NSTAR is cognizant of the budget challenges that are facing the state today. We would love to see the state continue to encourage this marketplace in whatever form it can to keep it as an attractive investment for producers. Before I do pass the presentation over to Moira, I do have one final note. I've mentioned that we are in a good place in the Cook Inlet right now. We are. However, we've also had the advantage of two very warm years in a row. We're also tracking in 2016. It's pretty balmy out there as well, and so it looks like we may end up having three very warm years. If we had experienced three cold years in a row, the current facilities that we have in place, they could have been stretched. So as a reminder for the committee, today, we only have one well into the kitchen lights units. So that's Fury's new development. There are no gas production wells in the Cosmo unit, so that's Bluecrest's unit. They're purely doing oil. We have four large fields in the inlet, which are old, and they're aging more every year. With cold weather, or even if one of the existing platforms or fields had an issue, we do not have a large contingency of backup alternatives. And as this committee knows, we have no interties to the Lower 48 or Canada. We are 100% dependent on this small, illiquid market to keep half of the state's population warm. So with that, I'll pass over to Moira.
Before you begin, Mrs. Green, I want to welcome Senator Costello and Senator Stoltz, who joined us several minutes ago.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Moira Smith, and I am Vice President and General Counsel of NSTAR Natural Gas Company. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. If you look at the graph on the screen, you will see a perfect illustration of why, as Jared said, we are a complicated customer. This is an actual representation of daily supply and demand in each day in 2014 and in 2015. You'll note several things when you look at the slides. First of all, you'll see the extreme daily variability. The black line represents our customers' actual takes on a day-to-day basis. And as soon as the weather gets cold, people turn up their thermostats. As soon as it gets warmer, they turn them down. Our job is to have the gas in the pipeline so that we can meet our customers' demand when that happens. So you see what Jared referenced, which is the 12-to-1 ratio, approximately 12-to-1 ratio, of customer demand from winter to summer. You also see a picture of a pretty diversified supply portfolio given the market in which we operate. You'll note on the right-hand side in the legend that we have contracts with AIX, which is the entity that succeeded Buccaneer after Buccaneer went through its bankruptcy. We have contracts with Cook Inlet Energy. We have contracts with Anchor Point Energy, which sold its assets to Cook Inlet Energy. And then we have contracts with Hilcor and Conoco. All of those contracts supplied our customers in each of those days in 2014 and 2015. Another important note here is to look at the CINGSA factor. If you look at the very bottom of the chart, the blue lines that go below zero represent CINGSA injections. The blue lines that go above zero represent CINGSA withdrawals. And so as you can see, the CINGSA withdrawal capability that NSTAR owns, the 20-year contract NSTAR has with CINGSA, plays a critical role in its ability to meet its customers' needs on a day-to-day basis, and of course allows us to inject in the summertime.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Coghill.
Just if anybody's listening in, that must be the storage unit, CINGSA?
Yes. Yes, Cook Inlet Natural Gas Storage.
Alaska.
Alaska, there you go. And that's not owned by NSTAR, am I correct?
Madam Chairman, NSTAR's parent company, SEMCO, owns 65% of the CINGSA Natural Gas Storage Facility. It is owned also in part by First Alaskan Cook Inlet Region Incorporated and then by subsidiary Berkshire Hathaway.
Thank you.
This chart also, up top, you see a reflection of the maximum daily, the peak deliverability we require from the marketplace in the event of a super cold day, and that's that 287 million cubic feet per year that Jared referenced. Now, this day only comes along every once, maybe a decade. It's only happened four times in NSTAR's history. But when that day comes, our obligation is to ensure that the gas is there for our customers. This next chart is a further illustration of the seasonality of our demand. This is a projection of one way that we could take our gas on an average day in each of the months in 2019 through 2021. Now, I'm going to talk about the Hilcor and Fury contracts in this discussion, but I'll go into them in more detail in a little bit. The first thing to notice is that the dark blue lines represent firm volumes that we will take under the Hilcor contract. Stacked on top of that are optional volumes represented by the light blue from the Hilcor contract. Then you see dark green, which are firm volumes we have to take from the Fury contract, and then light green, which are optional volumes from Fury. We have worked very, very hard in our new gas supply portfolio to ensure that we not only have our base load contracts in place such that we can ensure firm daily supply from our contractors and from our suppliers, but also to ensure that we have optionality. So on any day, we could choose, instead of doing the light green and light blue, we could choose to withdraw from CINGSA. And so that's going to allow us the flexibility to manage our storage volume and ensure that we have sufficient storage to get us through each winter. But at the same time, we can also buy from the market if, as needs be. You do see represented on this chart in the orange the daily Cingsa injections that we anticipate will take place. It's important to understand when you look at this, of course, that there is a marked difference between summer and winter, and that's just a further representation of the complexity and what we rely on our producers to offer us. This next chart helps to illustrate where we were looking when we sat down in 2014 to issue our RFP. This projects NSTAR's gas supply from now through 2023. If you focus on 2016 and 2017, you see NSTAR's portfolio of relatively small contracts. Because we knew that every gas supply contract we had was going to expire in 2018, in late 2014, we sent out an RFP to all comers, everyone in Cook Inlet who either actually was producing gas, had publicly stated their intention to produce gas, or even was in the process of doing seismic work or exploring for oil, to try to ensure that anyone who might have gas available to market to us was able to respond. We then engaged in intensive, protracted negotiations with these entities throughout 2015 and into the end of February 2016. Our first priority was to secure an anchor contract at reasonable prices, which would form the foundation for gas supply in our post-2018 world. These negotiations took over a year and resulted in APL 14, which is the new contract with Hilcorp that was filed at the end of February with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. I'll talk about that contract real quickly. APL 14 was signed on December 23rd, filed at the end of February. It represents approximately 70% or 110 BCF of NSTAR's gas supply needs from 2018 through 2023. It will supply around 22 BCF per year. And if you remember the light blue from a couple slides ago, there's optional volumes in there, which allow NSTAR a great degree of flexibility to manage the weather variability that Jared mentioned, not only on a daily basis, but also on an annual basis as well. This means NSTAR can ramp down deliveries or ramp them up as the weather dictates. Another key element of this contract is its reasonable price. You will remember that in 2013, the state of Alaska entered into a consent decree which resolved an antitrust investigation and set price caps. The price caps escalated at 4% annually. The weighted average annual price under APL 12, which is NSTAR's contract with Hilcorp that was based on consent decree prices, during its last contract year will be $8.33 per MCF. By contrast, the weighted average annual price for firm deliveries during the first contract year of APL 14 will be $7.56 per MCF. This is almost a 10% decrease.
Yes, Senator Stidman.
I was just wondering if there's a conversion into on the BTU equivalency over to oil.
Senator Stidman, through the chair, there is, and I'd be happy to follow up with that for you.
To the chairman.
Perhaps the most important feature of this contract is what it doesn't do. It does not meet all of NSTAR's gas supply requirements. What this means is that as of December 23rd, fully 30% of our portfolio was left open for other producers to fill. As a public utility, as Jared said, we value safety and reliability above all else. And we also understand that in the Cook Inlet market, we have to have and aim to have a diversified supply portfolio. This not only diversifies supplier risk, but it also helps to foster investment and drilling, which is good for the long-term stability of the Cook Inlet supply. We also entered into a second contract with Fury, as Jared mentioned. This contract will begin at the same time as APL 14. It is a three-year contract which will supply 20% of NSTAR's annual gas supply needs. And like the Hilcorp contract, it offers both firm as well as optional volumes, allowing us to manage our weather variability. That contract, as well as APL 14, are pending before the Regulatory Commission for approval at this time. Between these two contracts, NSTAR has 90% of its needs met through 2021. And to ensure the entire market had an opportunity, yet another opportunity to participate in selling gas to us, we sent another RFP to producers at the end of February to try to sort of recruit participants in our portfolio for the remaining 10% of our portfolio that's open starting in 2018. We believe between Hilcorp and Fury that these represent a huge measure of stability in the Cook Inlet gas market. Indeed, if improved, these will be the most significant gas contracts entered into in 15 years. Assuming commission approval, we will have laid the foundation of NSTAR's gas supply well into the next decade. Given where we were just 3 years ago, we consider this to be very good news. Jared?
So, thank you. As I noted before, we are working in a very delicate market with a small number of buyers, a very small number of producers. NSTAR has contracts that meet most of our needs out to 2021 and 2023, but we will need to negotiate extensions to these in the next couple of years. It is very important for all of South Central Alaska that we have a capable producer marketplace who will be there to provide the gas, molecules, and the deliverability that our customers in South Central Alaska need. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Jared and Moira, for the presentation. Any questions for NSTAR? Senator Costello.
Thank you. I'm aware that over our state's history that traditionally the gas contracts span decades. Could you just give the committee just sort of a brief comment on that, like how things have changed recently with these shorter contracts?
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Costello. In kind of going back a few decades, from NSTAR's perspective, it was, I would call it, the place that a utility wants to be. We were noise in the gas supply world. We were a tiny percentage of what the overall marketplace was producing and what was buying. So our significant seasonal needs were easily absorbed with the large assets and the large production that was occurring with the big players in the marketplace, with the Agrium facility that was producing, with the large LNG exports. We were almost inconsequential to the load challenges that were going on. And with that, the opportunities were available for very long-term contracts. We were also sitting with very, very large reservoirs. With the four large reservoirs we had, there were significant reserves that were very easily developable, especially along with the large loads coming off both Agrium and the LNG export facility. Roll forward to today, Agrium is closed, the LNG export facility, there's been a couple loads that have gone out in recent years, but earlier this year I was completely shocked when I saw world spot LNG prices hitting the high $8 range. Then I couldn't believe it when it hits the $7 range, and I think I saw it under $5 just a little while ago. It's a marketplace where we're not expecting to see a whole lot of gas going out of that LNG facility in the near term. So with producers coming in, we are now the large buyer in the marketplace. And we are very, very challenging on that end. And for producers to satisfy our needs and the deliverability, that graph that Moira had up of the 287 a day of needs, if the things are being 92 of that, it's just shy of 200 million a day of deliverability. We need producers to be able to deliver to us. That's a tough place for a producer to be able to commit to for a 10 or 15 year, 20 year period, because they're going to have the assets available to hit our peaks, but yet the average production they get, what we actually pay them for, is significantly less than that. So it makes for longer term contracts to be a little bit more difficult. Getting a 5-year contract that we have in place, we are very, very happy with that, because that is significantly longer term than what we were able to see back in the 2012 range. And so this is showing a measure of stability that's out, but it's definitely, it would be nice to have a 20-year firm agreement in, but that really isn't available in the market now.
Thank you.
Further questions for NSTAR? Seeing none, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Appreciate
very much.
That. All right, next up is the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. And online I have Mr. Bob Pickett, who is the chair of the RCA. Mr. Pickett, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me okay?
Very loud and clear. Thank you for joining us. If you would put yourself on the record and tell us about basically what the RCA is doing as much as you can. I realize there is confidentiality.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm Bob Pickett. I am chairman of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. I'll refer to it as the RCA. I've been a commissioner since 2008 and am now serving my fifth term as chairman. And I do appreciate that Chair Giesel, Vice Chair Costello, and members of the committee for the opportunity to be here. But I will say, when Chair Giesel contacted me earlier this week, I did stress some limitations on what I'll be able to say this afternoon. First, as has been indicated earlier, the RCA is engaged in a number of very critical proceedings involving Cook Inlet Gas. We do have the Hilcorp Instar purchase agreement before us. That's a 5-year agreement with some extension provisions covering approximately 106 BCF of gas. We also have the Fury Instar gas supply agreement, a 3-year GSA with some extension options of approximately 19 BCF. And starting later this month, in fact, in just a little over a week, we'll have a hearing concerning Municipal Light and Power and Chugach Electric's proposed purchase of Conoco's interest in the Beluga River unit. So I will not be able to address any questions or comment on the specifics of any of those three matters. At this point, we do not have a position on the specifics of SB 130, but I do believe it's fair to say, and I have several commissioners listening in, that the commission does realize the importance of the tax credits in the Cook Inlet gas market and the positive role that it has played over the last few years. I would like to go back a couple of years and outline the conditions that we were confronted in, and I would echo Mr. Green's comments that we're in a much better place than we were, say, 3 years ago, and I'd say a vastly better place than we were in 2009 and 2010. So I'm going to start with what the RCA does and doesn't do with regards to Cook Inlet Gas. We absolutely do not regulate the producers of natural gas in Cook Inlet. We do not regulate the wellhead price of natural gas. We do, however, evaluate gas sale agreements between the utilities and the producers, and in our standard of review, we consider whether the utility acted in a prudent manner, whether the terms of the gas supply agreement are reasonable, you know, whether the process to secure offerings of to provide gas to the various utilities was reasonable, and whether the gas supply agreement ensures reliable and reasonably priced utility service. One of the big contentions in Cook Inlet is historically it has not been an open and transparent natural gas market, particularly in the period of 2001 to, say, 2008 and 9. In 2001, the commission approved what was termed a Henry Hub order, which included a variety of pricing proxies that were considered by the utilities, the producers, the Attorney General, and the RCA. But from the period of 2001 to 2009, not a single one of those pricing proxies resulted in an RCA-approved gas supply agreement that delivered gas to utility customers. And that sort of led to a bit of a issue in the marketplace, and you saw that reflected in investment, the number of wells being drilled, and ultimately the exit from the marketplace of Marathon and Union. In 2010, there was great concern on the part of the utilities as to just where they were going to get their gas, and they contracted with Petrotechnical Resources of Alaska for a 2010 study, and NSTAR, Chugach, and MLMP sponsored that, and the conclusions at that time were quite alarming. In part, the legislature responded with their standard of review for the commission and the direction they gave to us as to how we were to evaluate gas supply agreements, and modified a section of 40 AS 4205-141 dealing with the general powers and duties of the commission, adding a section D, which, section D, when considering whether the approval of a rate or a gas supply contract proposed by a utility to provide a reliable supply of gas for a reasonable price is in the public interest, the commission shall, one, recognize the public benefits of allowing a utility to negotiate different pricing mechanisms with different gas suppliers and to maintain a diversified portfolio of gas supply contracts to protect customers from the risks of inadequate supply or excessive cost that may arise from a single pricing mechanism, and two, consider whether a utility could meet its responsibility to the public in a timely manner and without undue risk to the public if the commission fails to approve a rate or a gas supply contract proposed by the utility. I think that that general guidance has been helpful over the past 6 years, and we have seen a number of gas supply agreements approved in that time frame with a great variety of pricing mechanisms and peaking mechanisms within a particular contract. And as evidenced by the most recent contracts before us, I would like to commend the utilities for recognizing the importance of leaving a slice open for the smaller producers to come and become part of the picture to meet our needs. So with that, with the talk back 5 years ago of the possibility of having to import LNG into Cook Inlet as a result of the PRA study, to the current conditions we're at today, I think there has been great improvement. But I would also caution, I share Mr. Green's concerns, when we get out to the 2021, 2, and 3, and beyond era, just where we're going to be, because it takes significant investment for gas to continue to be produced. We saw a tremendous increase in Cook Inlet investment after the consent decree and after the ownership issues kind of stabilized, and there have been vast improvements in that area. But I think it's fair to say we're not entirely out of the woods yet. So with that, I will try to address any questions the committee may have.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Pickett. You are someone that the committee wanted to hear from. Committee members, any questions for Commissioner Pickett? Senator Stoltz.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome, Chairman Pickett. We make these decisions on rates at the consumer level, but they've made, it seems they made it of cascading decisions. What are some of the triggers that concern you as an advocate? I believe you have an advocacy role for consumers and of a fair regulated market, and both on supply and price and fairness. One of the things that are going to force you into, that might conceivably force you into decisions that are going to affect, I'm thinking of the service area where I live in. It's it was all the way, the entire Matsubara plus Chugiakita River. It's a population area of all of Southeast, all the small towns across the Prince William Sound and the Kenai Peninsula Borough. Is I think it's a comparable population. We're talking about a pretty big swath of people that have are dependent on a short-term contract. I think escalating up to about 8% by March of 18 when it expires. And what are some of the cautions I should have? And you as a watchdog, and with that, what you feel comfortable that you can comment on this, on the policy decisions we're facing, some of the cautions perhaps you might be able to share.
Well, I think one of the most important things on a policy level is we have to make decisions that encourage stability and movement towards a more competitive gas market in Cook Inlet. Now that's easier said than done. And I will say one of the things that's happened that has helped to rationalize the Cook Inlet natural gas market is the rationalization of the pipeline system, which was very fragmented, and I think I termed it to be a very balkanized system at a public meeting, and that has in fact happened. So it will make it easier, I believe, over time for smaller producers to access the pipeline system, know what the rules of the road are, and be very clear as to what the aggregate tariff is on that. It would be nice to have, you know, more competition, but the commission has to play the hand that it is dealt, because what the legislature has strongly cautioned us is we can't just reject contracts on the basis that we believe something better may come when there actually is nothing better in the time frame for which the contracts are being proposed. And I know that's sort of tough. That's a very tough thing to say, but and at the end of the day, it is the ratepayers that end up paying for this. I would perhaps perhaps be cautious in terms of the tax credits, and as I said, we have not taken a position on SB 130. But the existing decisions, investment decisions that have been made out in the inlet are based on the fact they can get utility contracts they can count on for some reasonable extended period of time to make their investment decisions. And obviously some decisions have been made on the nature of the credits that have been available. But that's a policy call that you folks are going to have to make.
Thank you. I appreciate the broad cautions, and I understand the constraints, but I appreciate have concerns about having a utility of that size with that many consumers, and myself included, and my family and my neighbors with a short-term contract right now. Our utility has made the decision to go with natural gas and on their own, and I think it's about 170 megawatt generator in a Kootenai, and that's the route that's went, and you just don't back up and change directions on that any more than you can change the direction on a decision that you've already made on a contract. I appreciate what you've been able to share.
Thank you.
Senator Stedman.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairman. I was wondering if the testifier has any idea what the BTU crossover is or comparison with oil, with the deliverable price of natural gas, so we can have a kind of an idea of just benchmarking the price of the energy source.
I don't off the top of my head, Senator Stedman, but I will get back to you in the next day with that.
Further questions for Commissioner Pickett? All right, seeing none. Commissioner, thank you very much for joining us. Like I say, we have observed that we haven't consulted you very often on these topics, and so I really appreciate you taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you.
All right, the next presenter is Mr. Tony Izzo. He is the general manager for Matanuska Electric Association, and he is online with us. Mr. Izzo, welcome.
Yes, Chair Giesel and senators, thank you much. I hope that you can hear me okay.
Loud and clear, thank you.
Great. Again, my name is Tony Izzo, for the record. I am the general manager of Matanuska Electric Association, or what I'll refer to as MEA. I've been in the utility industry for 35 years, a good part of that in the gas industry, and I suppose it's relevant just to mention that I was president of NSTAR Natural Gas and with NSTAR from 99 through about 2007, some of the period that has been discussed. I want to thank you, Chair Giesel, Vice Chair Costello, and the other members of the committee for allowing me to participate. I do have a brief PowerPoint presentation, and if we could go to page 2, I have a cooperative profile. I won't expand on this much. I know that you can read it. I would mention from this slide that MEA, we are the oldest electric co-op in the Rail Belt. We're celebrating our 75th year this year. We are the second largest, now serving the second largest population center in the state of Alaska. You can see our number of over 62,000 customers at this point, about 50,000 members, large service territory, as Senator Stoltz had indicated. Also, a generation portfolio that's 90% gas, 10% hydro. And then these last two bullets are meant to give you some perspective in terms of how much gas we buy. It's somewhat unfortunate, based on my experience, that MEA is the third largest gas buyer in the Cook Inlet today. That's a reflection on the fact that, in my experience, and I think it was Mr. Green had stated that even NSTAR was kind of background noise in comparison to the large industrial users, the Kenai LNG plant, the Agrium facility, and for MEA at 6 to 6.5 billion cubic feet to be the second largest, or the third largest and second largest electric utility is significant. And then to give you some perspective on cost, our annual cost is in the $45 to $46 million range for just the fuel. That doesn't include the transportation. That's a pretty significant number for a utility like ours. It represents 40% of the total cost of a kilowatt hour for a residential member or customer. So fuel is a large component of cost. On the next slide, I thought what I would do is answer three questions. This is page number three. And they are, what is MEA's supply forecast? What's changed in the inlet over 5 years? And then how have the tax credit programs in the inlet affected gas supply? On slide four, you'll see our publicly released or gas supply forecast. This is a chart that starts with 2015, goes out to 2026. That's not a very long timeline in terms of utility planning, but for fuel supply planning, we're coming off a period where it was very difficult to contract for maybe up to 2 years of supply. What you'll see here is that in green we have under contract all of the supply we need through March 31 of 2018, and then all of the red are unmet requirements. Maybe in an effort to answer a question and also to be able to say I said it here first, MEA, our board, we have negotiated a supply contract that our board has approved and we have executed, and we are in the preparation stages of filing this or preparing a filing for approval with the Regulatory Commission that will fill up the that red through 2022. So I'm confident as the CEO that we have gas supply available to us through 2022 and about a first quarter of 2023 at this point in time. On page five, I'd like to address the question of what has changed in the last 5 years. Now, I've been with Matanuska Electric 4 to 5 years, and I'm going to give you perspective that's a little bit broader that maybe goes back to 1999 in Cook Inlet. But 5 years ago, as was stated by others, specifically Chair Pickett from the RCA, gas supply was available in small quantities and short terms. I think it was an excellent point that Chairman Pickett made in that, and referring to something that Ms. Smith mentioned from NSTAR. I was at NSTAR in 2001 when we signed an agreement that was linked to the Henry Hub, and that agreement was capped at 450 billion cubic feet. It was a very large agreement. As I mentioned, it was linked to a three-year trailing average of the lower 48 prices. 2005, in response to some concerns, we filed our next agreement, which was a 12-month trailing average of lower 48 prices that would have filled up all of the gas utilities' needed requirements through this year, 2016. That contract was not approved in 2005-2006. And the result, if it were possible that those were in place today, we're looking at prices in the lower 48 that are in the $2 range, currently paying in the $7.42 range, which is the consent decree price negotiated by the AG. That's a significant difference, but the reason I raised the issue is what I witnessed at that time is when that contract was rejected, I witnessed Marathon and then others followed, slowly decreased investment and interest in the region. And it eventually evolved to a point where they left the inlet once their contractual obligations were either met and or sold to others. And that's what puts us to 5 years ago, and I think it's an important point because I would hate to see us repeat history. We were at a point where, as utilities, we could not support, many of us could not support things like extended LNG export. We were not in favor of industrial growth in the region or exporting gas to other parts of the state. And that really is not a sign of success. That's a sign of dysfunction. Because what you want to see is a market that is growing, expanding, attracting investment. The most significant positive change in the last 5 years has been the Hilcorp investment and the consent decree. As I was negotiating and looking for gas supply for Matanuska Electric 4 or 5 years ago, the best price we could get was $10 for 20% of our supply, and that was all we could achieve. So we joined with the other utilities looking for LNG import. Another significant change is the multiple new players that have invested significant capital. One of those that has invested the most significant capital is Hilcorp. But I think, as was pointed out by Mr. Green, and I'll expand upon a little bit, is that all of the gas that we now have under this existing contract through 2018 and maybe beyond, these are from mature fields, the same three or four fields that were discovered in the late 50s and 60s. So it's Hilcorp's core competence of increasing production from mature aging fields combined with the investment that has made the significant change for us, in addition to the significant change that we have multiple new players. What has not changed in the last 5 years, or is close to changing, is that we can all agree, whether it be the USGS, Department of Energy, and others, agree that there is gas in the Cook Inlet. In fact, in some places we know where it is, like the Cosmopolitan Field off of Anchor Point. The Kitchen Lights Unit, which Fury has begun producing from, and I understand enough volume, maybe a little extra, to support their existing contractual obligations. The concern for someone like me is that I look, as a buyer, I have to look at gas in terms of, is it behind pipe, meaning is it commercially available for me to enter into a prudent contract, arm's-length negotiation, such that it can be delivered. What I can't do is enter into a contract for gas that is maybe even proven, but might take hundreds of millions of dollars to put behind pipe because a production platform needs to be put in, or a well has to be drilled, and a pipeline has to be extended. That's not the core competency of a utility. On page 6, impact of the tax credit programs, from this buyer's perspective, is there's good news and there's bad news. And the good news is multiple new investors are available for gas supply discussions, and the life of mature fields have been extended. There have been some additional proven reserves put behind pipe. I mentioned Fury as one of those successes, and there are some others, small volumes, but others. And the other bit of good news is energy security, but I have to qualify that by saying I believe it's temporary energy security. Part of the bad news in terms of the impact is, at least today, is that significant new reserves are not behind pipe, which requires significant current and future investment to do so. So the impact of the tax credits has brought on access to gas that has been behind pipe for a long time. Maybe it wasn't producible or economic to produce and required a lot of investment. The bad news is that the new, I'll call it new gas, but from new fields, including many that USGS believes is out there, but we don't know where they are. But some of them, like Cosmopolitan and Kitchen Lights, we do. There is not a significant new volume that is behind pipe, and my concern is that it would take hundreds of millions to get it to that point. And there's a very long lead time involved with that, as in addition to the capital. On page 7, very quickly, I'll just note contingencies. We are an island in the sense of our energy infrastructure. We are the only climate where you have both seismicity and an Arctic climate or subarctic climate. And what that means is that contingencies are rolling blackouts, is curtailment. such that we can maintain the gas system, such that we don't have an interruption for long periods of time like days, weeks, or months. And this, coming from 20 years or so in the lower 48, is not a contingency that most markets would find acceptable, but that's the reality of our region and our market. And then finally, page 8 in summary, I would just say that uncertainty is the enemy of energy security, and I'm concerned about uncertainty. That's not to mean that I in any way am attempting to diminish the huge task that you all have and the appreciation that I have in terms of the state's fiscal situation. Exploration and production risks are not typical core competencies of a regulated utility. Really, that is just code for the fact that I'm going to work based off of economics. And if I find myself in a situation like we did 4 or 5 years ago, if it's going to take $400 or $500 million for exploration and production and a pipeline connection to maybe get gas in an area that I have no core competence, versus importing LNG for a price that's a little bit higher, I believe that importation, just like I did a few years ago, I thought we were going to have to do that prior to the consent decree, would be in the best interest of our customers. The bottom line is the cost to customer. Bringing new gas reserves to the point that can be prudently purchased by a regulated utility requires extensive investment and many years. And then I would say, because I've spent so much time in the private sector part of this business, the investor-owned utility business, I believe in metrics. If we have a program designed to deliver a result, we should have some metrics, key metrics, to determine what those results are. And in terms of the Cook Inlet and the impact of something like tax credits, which I think we can all agree have been very positive, but the real metric, in my opinion, is investment. That's the canary in the coal mine. When investment went away, starting in 2005, 2006, we ended up in a situation where we're practicing rolling blackouts or energy curtailment drills. And then with the, thanks to the legislature and the Cook Inlet Recovery Act and certainly CINGSA, those things turned it around and swung the pendulum back the other way. And the concern I would have as a buyer on behalf of my utility is, and really the whole region as an Alaskan, is that we don't create a circumstance where the investment goes away because it's such a long lead time and capital intensive type of business. And with that, I'll wrap it up and gladly take any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Izzo. Questions for Mr. Izzo?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Izzo. Can you give a little narrative? We've had the luxury of cooler winters, and that certainly reduces the amount of NSTAR supply for space heating. But what are the dynamics that will lead to your ability to provide power? It's I'm just speculating if there's a shortage and there's a increased demand because of cold weather. Is there a prioritization of how the utilities supply on priority for space heating over electricity? I don't think very many people at our prices heat with space heat with electricity. And what are the dynamics of weather on the use of electricity on its own and then coupled with the increased draw for space heating throughout the region? I might have a follow-up if I didn't ask it completely.
Thank you, Senator. Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, probably the first thing to compare to a gas utility, I believe that Mr. Green stated that his swing between summer and winter load is 12 to 1, so 12 times more is being purchased or used in the winter versus the summer, and that's consistent with my experience in the gas business. I've seen it in Alaska in extreme cases be almost 19 to 1. For a utility, an electric utility like Matanuska Electric, that is 94% residential customers. The remainder is commercial. We don't have any industrial to speak of. Our swing, or our difference in demand between summer and winter, follows almost more than weather, follows daylight. And what we see is a 2-to-1. So twice the energy is being consumed in the winter months as the lowest use during the summer months. The prioritization is a subject to a number of factors. Deliverability, first of all, is king, and that is the measure of being able to get the volume of gas at the moment that you need it. And sometimes that's a factor based on production at a well. It can be based on compressor capacity. It can be based on pipeline capacity, and it's based on where the demand is. In most jurisdictions, when I came up to this business in for my first 20 years in the lower 48 or so, we used a variety of measures. When it came to an extremely cold day and we had to meet what's referred to as a needle peak, because the last thing, if electricity goes out, you make the repair and you turn the power back on. If gas goes out, you have a much longer process of shutting off, repairing, purging, reintroducing gas, unlocking meters, and it's a whole process, and that's something the NSTAR folks could speak to. So as a result, what we would do here is we would curtail power. That's the right thing to do. Matanuska Electric is not a signatory to what's called the Gas Emergency Letter, which was signed in 2009, I believe. But essentially, what it does is it's an agreement amongst the utilities that rather than let the gas system go out, which is a priority to maintain heat in a very cold and dark place, we could attempt to reduce demand through a process of rolling blackouts a couple of hours at a time, moving it around the system. Certainly, if that were to occur, our constituents, my members and ratepayers and your constituents, would certainly become much more concerned about what plans are in place to address that. Again, in the lower 48, I had two LNG peaking plants at a gas utility I grew up at. We imported it from Algeria to Massachusetts. We trucked it down the coast. We stored it, and then we vaporized it when those days hit where we were seeing that coldest day in 2 years or 4 years. Matanuska Electric has prepared in our design. Our plant is different than the others for a variety of reasons. We probably wouldn't build a second one like it, but it's not a gas turbine that runs most efficient at flat out full throttle. We have a more efficient range of RPMs that we can run at, and the engines are dual fuel. We store about 1 million gallons of diesel, which would provide us enough power for approximately 4.5 days on a peak day. So we would look to offset any rolling blackouts with burning the diesel as a backup. And if it's not too presumptuous, because it's something we purchase, I'll just state here now that you need 7.3 gallons of diesel for 1 million BTUs to equate to 1 MCF of gas. I'm buying diesel right now in the $1.38 per gallon range, which means I'm paying about the equivalent of $10 and I think about 7 or 8 cents per MCF per equivalent of a MCF of gas, which is costing me $7.42.
I'm sure I just have
further questions, Senator Stoltz.
Yeah, one follow-up. Up until sometime in 2015, I attended regular meetings of, I forget what it was called, but it was basically an energy security committee, and it was led by the municipality of Anchorage and folks from Matsu Borough, and I remember seeing you there, Mr. Izzo. Are those types of meetings still being held, or is the crisis over?
Well, those kinds of meetings are not. With the change in the administration, I was chair of the Mayor's Energy Task Force, and I always appreciated seeing you there, Senator. We, as well as Chairman Pickett and many others, so that group essentially was able to shift its initial focus away from the immediate crisis. That's part of the good news, the interim good news of having the availability of supply. I could get all of my supply for 4 or 5 years, and I'll probably, as I mentioned, I'll be filing soon, announcing publicly soon, the details of an agreement to extend that out another 5 years. Although they're not happening at the municipal level led by the municipality of Anchorage that I'm aware of, the utilities continue to meet in what I would say is an unprecedented fashion of cooperation in regards to contingency planning. And I feel very comfortable because all of our generation units are, I mean, it's just the laws of physics. If you put a generator online, they become interlocked. And so we can all see what each other is doing. The number of transactions on a daily basis have gone from about 0 or 1 a year ago to 5, 6, 7 per day, where I'm buying the most efficient spin, I'm selling the most efficient energy, back and forth. And these are purely based on win-win economics between the electric utilities. So that coordination continues, and I'm very confident in our ability to address any type of emergency with NSTAR.
In closing, I appreciate the information on it. I was trying to find the status. I won't make any evaluative statements. There's been enough one-way comments about the legislature's competence, ability, and judgment by the chief executive of Anchorage. I don't want to go a tit for tat with that, so I won't. I just wanted the information. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Stoltz. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Energy supply is a function of price. And clearly, when the price gets so low, the supply dries up, and vice versa. If the gas into the rail belt is somewhere around $1 or $1.05 or $1.10 or somewhere down in there equivalent to oil, I know Senator Wilkowski's heard this comment from myself here for, I don't know how many years he sat here at this committee, but more than several, and the comment doesn't change. The so-called cheap hydro energy in Southeast is about $3.50 oil. 12 cents a kilowatt, somewhere in that ballpark. So if $3.50 oil is cheap, dollar oil must be free. I'm not quite sure how to connect that. We'll work on that as we discuss energy around the state and as we look to places like Iceland that have a flat energy price around their island to levelize the economic advantage and disadvantages that each section has. So, with that, Madam Chairman, that's Stedman's editorial. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Further questions? All right. Mr. Izzo, thank you so much for joining us. Very informative presentation.
Thank you very much, Senator and committee.
Committee, we'll next go back to the Department of Revenue. We finished yesterday on slide number 4. And we're going to continue that presentation. Now, that presentation is dated April 4th, 2016, and committee members will remember that Director Alper was going to update that slide 4. You should have the new slide 4. It is also up on BASIS for the public to view. And Commissioner Hoffbeck and Director Alper are coming to the table. While they are, you also will have at your table a summary of the statutes addressing the credits, just a quick reference document for you if you find that helpful. Welcome, Commissioner and Director.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue.
For the record, Ken Alper, Director of the Tax Division, Department of Revenue. Yesterday, when I sat before your committee, Madam Chairman, I apologize for the complexity of slide 4. Revised slide 4 is slightly more complex, but maybe more understandable. There are two, there's one row and one column. They are in orange on the screen in front of me, although they appear more green on the screen behind you. I don't know how that happened. And what we did in response to the question, the request of the committee, first off, we added a column for the production, so you can see what production from the North Slope looked like in thousands of barrels beginning in FY09 and then forecasted forward through 25. And then what we did, because we sort of had this alternative reality and where it was leading to in FY16, we then said, well, if we're going to really forecast, we have to reset to zero to what's the present day look like and say what's going to happen. And that's really looking at the issues of stacking up carried forward net operating loss credits going forward from FY16 into the future. So the new orange row is FY16 as it is, and then what the future will look like based on certain assumptions going onward. So on with that much information, I believe we spent most of our conversation yesterday talking about the history and what would have happened had we only appropriated money per the cap through the guideline language in AS 4355028. And the general idea was we would have endowed a fund, we would have built up a balance in that fund of approaching $600 million, spent down that fund in about FY15, and then been right around where we were in FY16 and we are now, difference being perhaps a different level of expectation and assumption as to the nature of the state's role in funding ongoing tax credits. So that's what was. Looking forward, the other change, before I keep going, is I've updated this slide with information from the final version of the spring forecast, which the commissioner released at about 2 o'clock this afternoon. I had enough access to those numbers yesterday that I was able to inject them into this slide. It doesn't make a whole heck of a lot of difference, some small differences in revenue assumptions, but really very, very tiny differences. So looking down into the FY17 row, I'm now the second row below forecasted. At the end of FY16, no matter what we all do, our credit account will be zero. The governor vetoed the number at $500 million last year. $500 million was transferred to the fund. By the end of the year, we will have spent $500 million. We have plenty of in the work pool and $20-something million dollars in the fund. So armed with all of that, we'll have $775 million roughly of claimed credits in FY17. Should the legislature appropriate either the 73 that's in the current budget or the 29 that's the revised figure from the credit cap, obviously we would be highly short-funded, over $700 million. And if we continue along those lines for the forecasted credit spend, or what's in the row, the column known as actual claimed credits, and that's what stacks up, but what we appropriate is only about the eighth or ninth column called credit cap per 4355028. The difference is what starts to accumulate, and then those big negative red numbers are what we're looking at as the credits that are owed by the state as we go from year to year. Meanwhile, happening almost in parallel to this is the idea of the non-cashable operating loss credits. Those are the ones earned by our major producers. There are a couple of small revisions in those numbers, primarily just in we switched. We had a little conversation about this yesterday to a more cash-based from an accrual system. In other words, we're not going to count count any credits that are earned at the end of FY16 until the end of calendar year 16 because it's an NOL. So because of that, we have a zero in the FY16 row there. Mm-hmm. And really all of those NOLs, that $618 million represents the operating loss credit for really calendar year 16, what will be on the books at the end of FY17, and those will be credits that we're going to have to pay someday indirectly, meaning that once the price of oil recovers, the major producers will subtract that number from their production taxes to the state. And when is that money going to be paid? Looking at the chart here, roughly in FY21 and 22. That's when you see the big numbers where the number is going down from $600 million down to $100 million. What that means is in those years, The difference will be a tax liability, but it will be subtracted from that liability, and taxes will be paid at smaller rates as we build down the NOLs. So long and the short of it is the last column on the right is the sum total of both the cashable credits that we've chosen not to cash because of limited appropriation, plus the non-cashable credits that are awaiting the return of higher oil prices. At the end of the day, come 2025, we would owe $2.8 billion. So that's what I got on slide four, but I have a sense there will be some questions.
I think they're lining up already. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just looking at this FY17, it looks like the numbers have been revised to that actual clean credits are being projected at $775 million. And then we receive a production tax of $59 million, which by my math leaves us with paying out $715.6 million more in tax credits than we're actually receiving in production taxes. Is my math correct?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilikowski, so long as we're just talking about the production tax, yes, your math is correct.
Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski.
Is there any other jurisdiction in the world that pays out more in credits than it receives in taxes that you're aware of?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilikowski, not to my knowledge. I can't pretend to have comprehensive knowledge of world tax regimes, but we have an unusual system, and it's an unusual time given our collapse in prices. And
thank you.
Senator Sinman, did you have a question?
Yeah.
I thought I saw your hand.
Yeah, I did. I think this is interesting, and it's a complex subject matter, so it's nice to see it in kind of in black and white. But when you view the department, you know, when you do a forward forecast of price, if it's, you know, here I guess we're looking at in the $60 price range in the forecast. So when you do the projections, you always fold in these NOLs and so on and so forth. So when we look to our, in the future, when we look to our presentations or stuff, that's just something that Department of Revenue is going to have there, so we don't inadvertently not have them put in there and have a projection of rising revenue when it doesn't. And the reason I bring that up is one of the concerns I have is when we get into the future, whatever, you know, that's going to bring, we're going to have to pay off these liabilities, and they're right around $2 billion. It's going to be, I think, hard to, as a policymaker, to explain to the public we have advancing prices, yet we have not advancing revenue to the state, the production tax. And I just kind of, I guess I'm looking for, you know, some discussion on that or how we're going to deal with that.
Through the Chair, Senator Stedman, just to kind of follow up on the earlier part of your question on whether it's going to show up in the reports. The Revenue Sources Book projects revenues separate from expenditures. And so the cashable credits are not going to show up as a negative against the revenues. There's a line item in the Revenue Sources Book that does show them as an expenditure, but the revenues would be without, they aren't net of the cashable credits. So it's in there, but you're going to see a revenue number that does not reflect the cashable credits in the revenue line.
If I could just add one thing to that, Madam Chairman, Ken Alper again. For example, last year when we anticipated more credits than there was money appropriated, that $200 million does show up in this year's forecast. That's part of the $775. Should something similar happen at the end of this year when we're doing the revenue forecasting in the fall, if there's a carried over number, that one-time carried over number will roll into our FY18 forecast. But it's really hard to forecast those more than 1 year ahead. We only know what there is that wasn't funded. You know, we can't forecast what the legislature is going to fund, essentially, from year to year.
Thank you. Mr. Alper and Commissioner Hoffman, if you could identify yourselves, that's for the folks listening, and then, of course, the minutes later.
Absolutely.
Senator Wilikowski, then Senator Costello.
Yeah, thank you. Just going back to this question of how much more we're paying out than we're taking in, it looks like in FY15 we had $628 million in tax credits paid, and we actually had a production tax of $363 million. So we lost money in 15, 16, 17, we're projected. We're projected to lose, pay out more, and correct me if I'm wrong here, we're projected to pay out more in production tax credits, oil tax credits, than we receive in production taxes all the way out to 2024. Am I reading that correctly?
To the Chair, Senator Wilikowski, yes, that is the way that the chart reads.
And if I could, Madam Chair.
Senator Wilikowski.
And then in 2025, we're paying out, projected to pay out $250 million, and we're projected to receive $275 million in production taxes. But then when you factor in the credits against liabilities, we're still projected to have a loss that year. Am I reading that correctly?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilikowski, no, the 275 number is after subtracting the credits against liability. The reason for the if you look at the column to the right of that, there's a $370 million. That's the tax liability based on the calculation, and then the 95 would come off of that in various credits against liability, and 275 would be actually received by the state.
Got it. Thank you.
So Mr. Alper, the decline that you've projected here, what is the percent of decline that is being projected? This comes from Revenue Source Book, so.
Through the Chair, Madam Chairman, that you're talking about the
barrels in the orange
production, certainly.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Between where we are today at round numbers, 500,000 barrels, and if we are in fact at 300,000 barrels in 2025, that would be a 40% decline between 500 and 300.
Per year. Commissioner Hoffbeck.
For the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner Revenue. Between 4 and 5% decline a year.
So you are basing this projection on the assumption that, assuming this bill passes, that companies who are losing money now will continue to invest, and that we'll have the projected, 4 to 5 to 6% decline, when in fact, if they stop work, we'd be looking at a 12 to 15% per year decline. Have you taken into account any of those rational decisions that a company that's losing money would make?
Madam Chair, there's some of that's already embedded within the forecast of decline, because we only project investment that's currently ongoing or is planned and sanctioned, and any new investment isn't part of our forecast already. As far as the 15% decline, fields decline at a kind of a hyperbolic rate, and so they tend to flatten out as they get older in their life. They've got a very steep decline when they come off a peak, and then they tend to flatten out. And I don't really know where the field is. I'd have to have somebody from DNR or somebody come in to talk about where we are in that decline curve, whether it's 15 or 10 or 7. I don't know what it is without any additional investment.
Sure. Well, before Senate Bill 21, we were experiencing about a 6% decline, and that was with significant investment to keep that decline at only 6%. So with the withdrawal of three rigs, which I don't know if you've calculated that in here, that decline curve will accelerate. But we can certainly get some geologists in here to answer that question more thoroughly.
The three rigs, because there was a question embedded in that, I just wanted to clarify. The spring forecast does somewhat account for the three rigs. We received updated information from the operator of Prudhoe Bay, and we worked their revised numbers into the spring forecast.
Okay, thank you. Senator Costello.
thank you. So, Mr. Alper, it's my understanding that at some point with companies experiencing net operating losses, that the amount of revenue that the state will get from royalty will exceed the production tax. Is that correct?
Through the Chair, Senator Costello, that's currently the case. I believe it's been the case for the last several years.
Follow-up, Senator Costello.
So license companies are paying income royalty and production in addition, excuse me, property in property tax in addition to the production tax. And would it be possible for you to either on this slide or on an additional sheet just sort of have a column that shows the complete picture that we are the state is receiving from the companies?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, certainly we could do that. I want, because when these numbers have been thrown around in the last couple of weeks since the spring forecast, there's been some controversy or at least disagreement over what's the appropriate number. I want to make sure we have the right thing. There's been some attention paid to the idea of total unrestricted general fund petroleum revenue because for the first time that number is below the credit forecast. There's also the entirety of petroleum revenue, which includes such things as a permanent fund deposits from royalty, CBR deposits from assessments, and that kind of thing. What I would prefer to do is put both as two additional columns, if that would be all right with you.
Director Alper, would it be helpful if you knew that we have the document that was released this afternoon on our desks? And if I'm not mistaken, revenue coming in from all of those things are on page 14. Members should have that at their desk. Property tax, corporate income tax, hazardous release, etc., royalties.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Yes, that number shouldn't be terribly different from what we had a couple of weeks ago. I've been...
This was released today.
Well, I know. I've been a little busy today, so I haven't actually read the final version of it. But that number, I'm glad that you have that. I'm glad your members have that. That number sounds about right, about a billion one all in with all the petroleum sources. Right.
Thank you. Senator Stedman?
Well, just as we talk about the decline curve, back in 2012... when we were under ACES, Senate Bill 21 wasn't a concept then. There was testimony in Senate Finance about the parabolic curve. We were approaching the 2 to 3% decline curve rate at that time. And there was no testimony brought forward to the committee, as I recall, to get off of that parabolic curve. And you can't change the geology of the basin by changing tax codes, not only here but anywhere else. So this parabolic curve that's been mentioned is something that has been studied for decades, probably a decade and a half, as we did research and found old studies done in comparisons with Pluto and other mass fields around the planet. So what you can do is you can bring it forward in time or production, but you can't create anymore that's in the ground. And what we saw from that testimony then is as you change policy to increase the production in the near years, you actually increase the decline out in front of you several years. And that has become a problem with a lot of sovereigns around the planet. So, I guess we'll see how our basin responds, but the 2 to 3% decline curve was forecasted in testimony since finance in 2012, and it might even have been in 2011, because we spent 2 years having hearings on ACES as we tried to restructure ACES, which was then restructured, following that. So this is, it'd be interesting to go back when we want to entertain ourselves and look at the production expectations back then to where we are today. In that 2 to 3% range.
Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. And just following up on that, my recollection, and I recall this very vividly, is the many advertisements that we heard saying that we stopped the drop after we passed Senate Bill 21. And in fact, we named the bill the More Alaska Production Act. And if you look at the production that we had in the last year of ACES was 2012, we had 579,000 barrels. And if you look at the production that's forecast out to 2025, it's 302,100 barrels. So is it fair to say that under the More Alaska Production Act, we have not neither stopped the drop nor added production? Is that a fair statement?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski. The decline has continued, but to say that we haven't added production, I think, would probably be not justifiable. I think there has been added production, but not enough to totally stop the decline.
You'll be okay with us checking with Division of Oil and Gas on that, right?
Madam Chair, absolutely. The production has declined, but there's been new production as well. So I'm trying to parse the difference between the two. So
thank you. Follow up, Senator Willikowski.
I mean, essentially, all production is new production. I mean, virtually all production is new production. And would you agree that 302,000 barrels of oil being produced in 2025 is less than 579,000 barrels that were produced in the year before the More Alaska Production Act was passed? Would you agree with that basic concept?
Through the Chair, Senator Willikowski, yes.
Thank you. Yes.
And Commissioner Hoffbeck?
Yes.
How certain are you of the forecasts that you make out to 2024-25?
Madam Chair, there's a lot of conservativeness in that particular forecast. We risk future production in order not to over-forecast.
And have you considered the Repsol Armstrong field that is potentially coming online in the next 5 years?
Madam Chair, it is not in the forecast.
Thank you. Senator Costello was next.
Yes, thank you. For either one of you, so do you know the opportunity cost for capping the tax credit fund and not providing cashable credits to companies? Have you looked at the opportunity cost?
No. Chair, Senator Costello, for the state or for the industry? Or?
Well, it would be for the state, and based on the industry's behavior, their investment behavior as a result of that. So I see them as related.
Through the Chair, Senator Costello, it's hard to project what might not happen, say, if we make the changes proposed in this legislation. Later in this presentation, where we introduce the modeling, we show how we might be impacting project economics, that decision-making metric that might lead to the follow-up and say, well, maybe this one might not happen, but another one will. But the opportunity cost is only a cost if something doesn't happen, and that's what becomes very hard to calculate. How much new stuff might we not get if we make these changes is very, very hard, if not impossible, to tell.
Follow-up, Senator Costello.
So are you suggesting that there are no opportunity costs in some scenarios?
No. Through the Chair, Senator Costello, on the one hand, there's the opportunity cost of spending money on credits that, say, wasn't necessary if the project was going to happen anyway, and then we've paid money that we're going to get the same revenue on the back end, then that's a cost in the other direction. I'm just saying that there's too many variables to be able to conclusively say what will or won't happen with the changes. I guess that's why it's a deliberative process to have these conversations.
Thank you. So, Director Alpert, do you feel that hardening the floor will help or exacerbate this carry-forward issue that is illustrated on your chart?
Well, Madam Chairman, hardening the floor was conceived of as an issue last year when we realized that we were going to have, most specifically, operating loss credits that were going to be used against the floor. And then the idea is, if we're in a gross tax regime, other states that are in a gross tax regime actually get their gross tax. We might be getting to the place where we're not going to be getting it. So now suddenly we're looking at a new variable of these stacking up, for lack of a better word, carry forward losses. But the answer to your question directly is no, it actually makes it worse. If Company X earns $500 million in carry forward losses and they can use $200 to offset their minimum tax and therefore carry forward $3, we'd be asking them to carry forward all five, and therefore the impact in the future when prices go up would be even more. There is a larger problem of the operating loss credits that is not being addressed in this legislation.
Thank you. Senator Stedman?
Thank you. I'm going to back up here for a minute, if I could, Madam Chairman, to the previous discussion around the table that some people find entertaining. When you look at the decline versus what was expected in 11 or 12, and you go forward, I'd say there has been some marginal increase. how much you can actually measure would be interesting compared to what was actually going to be built anyway or done anyway. And that's hard because there's not only corporate politics involved in slowing down particular projects to get a benefit you want in the tax structure, and state politics involved, and to parse all that and actually definitively measure it, I think it's going to be pretty hard to do. But clearly the numbers are going down, and even if they were flat at 490 or 500, it would still, it looks to me like it would still lead to a position for the state to take very seriously these NOL credits going forward, so we have some form of plan to deal with them. And quite frankly, it's pretty easy for revenue to, I think, to assume, you know, 490 or 500 going out till 25 or any other you know, reasonable time frame, and give us a sensitivity test on dealing with these type of problems by changing price and volume. And like one of our colleagues said, it's a crapshoot. You know, if we stay at 500,000 barrels, it's going to help fix the problem. And if we go to 450, it's not going to be helpful.
Through the chair, Sarah Stedman, just going back to the forecast of production, I think one thing that we need to be cognizant of is the laying down of the rigs and those kind of things being driven by oil price. And there's very little that we can do with credits to overwhelm $38 oil. I mean, the decisions that are being made are because they simply can't produce at $38 at a profit. So, you know, so that's, I think, one of the things we need to take into consideration. We throw a lot of money at it right now, and it may not make a difference on activity. And it's more when you get to that marginal area where project may be or may not be economic, where the credits, I think, really probably have more of a significant impact than they do. I think at this level, I don't think they have much of an impact as far as activity. I think that we're going to go into a slow activity time period until the prices recover.
Follow-up, Senator Stedman, followed by Senator Machiki.
Right, just a quick follow-up, and thank you, Madam Chairman. You know, it looks like when they're going to lay down these rigs and slow down, that will at some point, if it's a 4 or 5 year delay, have an impact on production. And it'd be nice if, you know, at some point we could get a briefing on that, Madam Chairman. Just and it's, you know, may not be indicative of the tax bill we have in front of us, but just for general knowledge, because you can't lay down rigs and have it beneficial for production. We all know that. And it's, from my understanding, it's kind of a delay to get them back up. So we're going to be, at some point, if it's 3 or 5 years out, looks like we're going to be in a window where it's not, you know, that what's going on today is going to affect that production. And at the same time, we're trying to deal with these NOLs. So we end up with this, you know, we end up in a pickle. And it'd be nice to get kind of a feel for it. Maybe we can help mitigate that through the, you know, the legislation we work on.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. I made a mistake. It's actually Senator Stoltz next.
No,
please go
ahead.
No, go ahead.
I'm trying to remember my question. It's not a hardball question like, is 500 bigger than 300 million? I don't have a real hardball question like that, but I've actually forgotten my question.
Well, I'll let you think about it while Senator Machiki goes with his question.
And Madam Chair, I actually need to run to finance, and I would love to stay for the conversation we've had 100 times, because it'd be just as much fun the 101st. But if you look at the decline rate for 15 years following FY14, then you look at an absolute flattening for 7 years, even with your conservatism designed into the model, we have flattened the decline. And if that's the most that we accomplish in forward tax policy, and we deal with the issues with some of our credits and perhaps reviewing where we need to harden the floor and those other options, it's certainly a better direction than things were heading, and for anyone to deny that, I'm not sure what metrics you'd be using, but it wouldn't be the ones that I see on this page or the ones that I know are happening with production. So I, Again, I know we like to have that discussion, and we have it often, but and I'd love to stay. But we are trying to pass out Senate Bill 91 today, Madam Chair, so I do have to go.
Yes, thank you, Senator Machicki.
Thank you.
And I certainly would point to 20, 25, 300,000 barrels. We're going to be in a really bad place, regardless of what the price is. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. I'm not going to ask any more hardball questions.
I want to know, is this Common Core?
Base 8, Matt.
It's day 80.
It's all right, took us down a path.
With, I did have a question, though, on the laying down of rigs. Can companies write off the costs or get, or are they eligible for tax credits for laying down rigs?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I'm going to get a little beyond my own core competency here, and I will get the rest of the answer back to the committee. Because I know that we have denied credits for example, rig. What do you call them when you rent them when you buy when you hold them but then not using them?
Standby
fees. Thank you. We don't pay for standby fees. So my expectation is if you had been using it and likewise you stand it down, you also aren't going to be allowing those sorts of costs to be creditable or deductible. But the precise way that we regulate that and have handled that, I will get that written up properly and brought to the chair.
Thank you. Further questions on the chart? Senator Stedman.
Just one as we're digging up old bones and throwing them around the table. Madam Chairman, I might have revenue run the current tax structure at $40 relative to ACES at $40 relative to ELF. If that's not a complete overload, I'm assuming that with all the magical models they have, I know they got it down a fairly simple one and a very complex one, but I've got confidence in revenue that they can do that, or maybe we can have our consultant do it at $40, which is the basic price range we're in. If you could be so bold to ask such a bony question.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, we can. We have two things about ELF. One, it's probably going to win at $40 oil, much to our great chagrin. But second, one thing we've stopped doing over the last 10 years is track and calculate and project what the ELF multipliers on a field-by-field basis would be. So we're left with a little bit of theory as to what the actual ELF tax rate would have been had it been in place all these years. But to the extent we could fake that a little bit based on past trend lines, we should be able to answer your question.
And Director Alper has noticed us that he works nights, so I'm sure he'll accomplish that by tomorrow. No, I'm kidding. It's okay. Any further questions on the chart? He has quite a few more slides. All right, let's move on.
Madam Chair, I think we might need a brief and ease as Ike spins up the prior presentation.
All right, we'll send it ease. We're back on the record, and we are now on slide number 5. Director Alper.
Thank you, Ken Alper. Here, 4 and 5 were both supplemental slides added after questions at the hearing on the 2nd of April. The question asked, I had gone through an analysis of the so-called work pool, what was before the tax division as far as credit applications, and the request was made to break them out into Cook Inlet and Middle Earth versus North Slope. We've done that here. $675 million was the number we were working from. The so-called older NOL credits versus the older exploration credits, you can see how they lay out. The exploration are all Cook Inlet. The NOLs are somewhat split. The big pile, the end of last year, this reverses a little bit of the trend line that we saw for the prior 2 years, which was a very Cook Inlet heavy spend. What we have in 2015 was a lot of North Slope spending. $552 million of those NOLs and drilling credits, the two-thirds of them were North Slope. And, of course, those are all NOLs, that 335. The 217 for the Cook Inlet Middle Earth number is some sort of blend of them. We don't quite have the ability to parse those out in front of you. But in general, those companies who are earning NOLs, it's going to be about 50-50. And then there are the companies that don't earn NOLs, and those are going to be entirely just the drilling credits. That meaning the profitable producers who are earning credits based on their ongoing well work. We can't really split those out. We would be impinging in some ways on the confidentiality of those companies who aren't earning the NOLs. There's not too many of them. The 2015 exploration credits, those are, you know, I mentioned some a slug of last-minute exploration credits tied to the sunsetting credits. Those were particularly relevant in the North Slope area because we had an 85% credit support for a limited window of time. The 40% exploration credit stackable in calendar year 2015 with a 45% NOL. So my sense was companies were saying if they were going to drill an exploration well in the next few years, might as well do it in 2015 because the system was calibrated to their maximum benefit. And like the few credits that are going to be refiled are North Slope heavy, but general thrust of it is 422 versus 253. I hope that's adequate detail for the moment. We can keep the committee updated as we get through the year, but that's the best we know at the moment.
Okay, thank you. Any questions on this slide, on 5? All right, moving on to 6.
6 and really 7. These are, so now we're into the meat and the detail of Senate Bill 130 and the various sections of the bill. Section 7 of the bill is on the topic of interest rates. This is not an oil and gas specific section. These are in the general statutes of the Department of Revenue describing how interest is charged on assessments, essentially audited delinquent taxes. When we come back in and say, company, you did not pay your taxes properly. The historic interest rate was quite high. Going back to the 70s, it had been in statute at 11% compounding. The bill, as it worked, there was a Senate bill. It worked through various Senate committees. We're talking about Senate Bill 21. The rate was reduced. The intent of the bill was to reduce that from a fixed 11% to a number that was 3% above the federal discount rate. That's the number that survived through all versions and iterations of the bill as it left its many committees. However, there was an awkwardness with Senate Bill 21. It was a controversial piece of legislation. It did not have enough votes passing the Senate to pass an effective date clause. What that meant when the bill got to the first House committee was they needed something of a workaround. And the workaround, the statutory workaround, is to use what they call applicability language. And there was some somewhat cumbersome language added to the bill that said production prior to January 1st, 2014 is X. Prior production after January 1st, 2014 is Y. And the new intent, the new interest was in that after section. But meanwhile, the compounding language found its way through the system in all versions, including House Resources. But there was a technical error in House Resources. The last committee substitute, I'm on slide 8 in House Finance, fixed that technical error, but that CS got back that higher of 11% language that was in the original law, the existing law that was being amended by Senate Bill 21, but the compounding was there. So as you know, Madam Chairman, most big bills, after the work draft CS is put on the table, there's often a technical amendment by the chair that cleans up a lot of the smaller provisions in the bill that are brought to the chair's attention in that day or so while amendments are being taken. This was an amendment by Co-Chair Osterman, which had 6 or 8 different changes to the bill, minor things. These things always pass unanimously. They're not controversial. But in doing so, while eliminating that or at an annual rate of 11%, whichever is greater phrase, also deleted the compounded quarterly as of the last day phrase. No one really caught it. The bill passed the House. The bill was concurred with in the Senate, became law, and lo and behold, Alaska no longer had compound interest on any of its taxes for the first time in 30-some years. That is the state we're at right now. It's a simple interest calculation on all delinquent taxes. This quarter, the number is 4%, the 1% federal discount rate plus 3. So what we're seeking, slide 9.
Mr. Albert, pause for just 1 second. I appreciated you mentioned on page 7 when you were starting this is that this is in general statute. It doesn't apply to just oil and gas. So this is applying to other industries as well?
Madam Chairman, it's applying to other taxes as well. So we're talking about all the taxes collected by the tax division, corporate income tax, tobacco, mining, fish, et cetera, et cetera. We have auditors in various specialties throughout the tax division that are expert in those particular taxes. They audit their taxpayers. It's less high profile, smaller dollar amounts generally than we experience in oil and gas, but the net effect is the same. We send you an assessment notice for unpaid taxes plus interest. The statute in question in 4305 talks about the calculation of that interest.
Thank you. So the answer is yes.
Yes.
It applies to other industries as well.
Other taxes. Just wanted to, yes.
Sure. Thank you.
Short answer. So we have a lot of slides. Thank you. So there on slide 9, the intent of the legislation was to find something of a middle ground, the historic 11% and the current effective 4%. And the underlying idea here is right now we are funding the budget out of our savings. We all have to more or less agree that. That's our reality. Therefore, and a dollar that's not received in taxes is another dollar out of those savings. And consequently, when we do finally get paid that dollar, because we've gone back to the taxpayer in whatever industry and said, this is the tax you owe plus interest, the interest should in some way compensate the state for the cost for not having had it in savings for the intervening years, effectively our opportunity cost, what we would have earned. So the intent of Section 7 of the bill, the way it was worded, was to try to find a number that roughly approximated what the permanent fund expected to earn on their money, because that's the biggest savings account that we have, where perhaps in the relatively near future we might be using to fund our ongoing government operations. So once again, when the tax is eventually paid, it should compensate what it would have earned had it stayed in savings. The permanent funds estimates that number to be about 7% right now.
Thank you, Director Alper. And so vice versa also applies. In other words, if the state has collected too much tax, they owe it back plus this interest.
Madam Chairman, yes. At the same rate of interest, and this applies not just if someone overpays their taxes, but if someone pays the amount that we assessed, contests it, goes through the process, appeals, courts, what have you, wins or even partially wins, and we pay them back with that same rate of interest going back to the original assessment data.
Short answers.
Thank you for the clarification. Commissioner.
To the chair for the record, Randy Hoffman, Commissioner of Revenue. The intent with this was not to make it a revenue source or a revenue loss, but to try and make it as revenue neutral as we possibly could for the state. So whether we got we collected interest on a tax that owed, or we paid interest back on a refund, it would essentially mirror what we would have had if it was in our investments. So.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman, so slide 10 attempts to model that a little bit with the expectation of the effective date for this section in the bill of July 1st of this year. So through the first two quarters of 2016, if we had $1 million debt, that million earns, it pays interest at 4% per year. That's a straight $10,000 per quarter. That's what we mean by simple interest. So over the six quarters in the current law, there would be $60,000 worth of interest. But beginning in the third quarter of 2016 with the amended version of the language, first off, the interest would double to the roughly 8%, and second, the interest would be applied not to the just the original million, but to the million plus interest that was accruing. So you can see the numbers across that bottom row creeping up, 20,000, 20,400, 20,808. That's the effect of the compounded interest. So really there's two decisions before the committee as you address that section. Should we switch to compound interest in the first place, which I honestly and sincerely believe is an inadvertent technical error from Senate Bill 21 that just got missed along the way, and then secondly, should we increase the rates to try to make interest something more of a revenue-neutral phenomenon for the state?
So, Director Alper, the interest being compounded, is it compounded monthly, quarterly, annually?
Quarterly, Madam Chair.
Thank you. No further questions.
So slide 11 just sums up this interest rate change section. It's very hard to quantify a revenue impact because we don't know what we're going to assess. We did complete the calendar year 09 production tax assessments last week. The total was $132 million. So that is a number we've said to others. About a third of that was interest. There's very little near-term impact. This is one of those ones that'll build up value over time. And when it comes to oil and gas, it's not GF revenue anyway. Any assessment, any tax appeal, any tax conflict, all of that money goes to the Constitutional Budget Reserve. So the only GF impact we'll see from this change will be in those other industry taxes that you referred to earlier.
Very good. So you took the full statutory limit to complete the 2009 audit?
Madam Chairman, we did. It was for the last couple of years we've done so. We had to slow down our audits for a while to build up to the new software and catch up to some things. We're doing 2010 and 11 concurrently and should be 1 year caught up by a year from now.
Thank you. Questions, Senator Stedman?
I was just curious. You know, when we take money out of the CBR, we're technically borrowing it. And when we put interest back in, because, for example, if it's the 4.8, whatever it is coming out of this issue that we have in front of us, does that count as a partial repayment back to the CBR, or do we still owe the whole amount from some other source? Or if you don't know, you can always get back to me. It's a nuance. I'm just curious.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, those would be new deposits to the CBR, and so we would still have a liability. But that's my understanding, but I will confirm that to make sure that is, in fact, the case.
So, Director Alper, a quick question about this this software that you use. I think I saw in the fiscal note of this bill another appropriation to upgrade that software yet more. Am I recalling correctly?
Madam Chairman, the software contract was in excess of $25 million originally, and the full appropriation was 34 and change of some of that, covering our other costs involved with implementation and consulting services and the like. The fiscal note for this bill is $1.2 million. That, you know, all of the revenue bills have some degree of a fiscal note involved in the reprogramming and testing. It's a relatively laborious process. This one is bigger, frankly, because of the interest change. Well, the first, it's a more comprehensive bill. There's a lot of changes. Second, because we're going to be in all 24, 25 of our taxes with changing the interest rate formulas, that itself makes it a little bit more of a comprehensive comprehensive task.
Thank you. On to slide 12.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So now we're talking about increasing the minimum tax. There's a bunch of different sections of the bill that deal with the minimum tax itself. Section 12 is purely about the raise from 4% to 5% as proposed by the governor. So what we have here is the approximate revenue curve. The blue line is the expected revenue at a 4% minimum tax, and with the gray line is the effect of our 35% production tax under SB 21. And you can see where that would typically hit the zero line. It's somewhere in the neighborhood of $70 oil. But the blue line kicks in because we have the gross minimum tax as an alternative. And the effective tax curve of Alaska today is the blue line to the left of where it hits the gray line and the gray line to the right. That's where we are today. If we were to raise that to 5%, two things happen. First, of course, the taxes increase at lower prices. And secondly, the crossover point moves to the right a couple of dollars just because of the nature of those curves. And you can see that where the orange touches the gray, slightly to the right of where the blue touches the gray. So that's just a graphical showing of what a 4% minimum tax works out to. And you can see, in response to the earlier questions and the difference between SB 21 and ACES, say that minimum tax number at those lower prices is your difference under most circumstances. ACES would be at zero throughout that lower price range. SB 21 raises, you know, 100, 200, in some cases, $300 million under the minimum tax, with the caveat to that being that's in the first year of very low prices. In the second year of low prices, the operating loss credits start to wipe out that minimum tax, which is not shown on this graph before you right here. If I may move to slide 13.
Oh, Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. So just to make sure I'm clear on what I'm looking at, the slide is an example without the NOLs. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes.
Yeah. So if we assume at some point we're going to put the NOLs in, when we talk about, you know, what kind of bear trap we're walking into, they would then be engaged in the deflection point of the blue line and the gray line, I assume, and then some effect on that as it goes up. You can see where you're out of the minimum tax, where it kind of bends or at 80, I guess, on the
on the 5% or 75 or so, 76 on the current tax, and then that future price curve then would be distorted down?
Through the chair, Senator Steadman, I'm not sure I followed all of that. If the NOLs were accounted for in this slide, meaning in the second or third year of low prices, the revenue turns out to be about a zero. This is a snapshot of the first year. If you start using NOLs against taxes, I imagine it would, depending on how high the stack of NOLs is, it's going to drag the overall revenue curve down in the future years. But that would not be so much a function of this year's price. It would be a function of last year's NOLs.
This was Senator Steadman follow-up.
Yeah, I probably garbled up that question, but correct, the historic NOLs, so we wouldn't expect, I shouldn't expect revenue in the millions to climb, north of 80. As steep as that, because it doesn't have the potential couple billion that are going to flow against us at some point when we get there.
Correct.
Under the current scenarios.
Through the chair, this assumes that there isn't that drag of the NOLs from the past. If I could move to slide 13, we're on the same topic, and this is just more graphic showing of the what's the fiscal impact of an increase to the minimum tax. And obviously, 4% is 4% of something. It's 4% of the gross value at the point of production. Gross is roughly the equivalent of the market price minus $10, the transportation cost to get it there. And there's about 160 million taxable barrels per year produced, so 4% of whatever that would be. And then the additional 1%, you could see at $30 oil, that's about $20 million, and it goes up as the price of oil increases up to upwards of $80 million at $75 oil, and then it drops off. And the reason for that is, of course, past $75, $78 oil, we get out of the minimum tax and into the regular tax, the net tax, and so at higher prices, there's no impact of increasing the minimum tax. It's purely an academic exercise. What is the minimum tax? Which, for all the years we had a minimum tax, it never kicked in. It was never a relevant part of the conversation of the actual tax calculation until the last months of 2014. So that's roughly the fiscal impact of this specific section of the bill. For simple terms, we've called it $50 million, but it's actually a somewhat variable number tied to the price of oil. Meanwhile, elsewhere in the bill are these more complex sections that do this thing called strengthening or hardening the minimum tax. Senate Bill 21 did make the minimum tax stronger than it previously was, and it did so by saying that the sliding scale per barrel credit for legacy oil on the North Slope, specific, as in 4355.024 sub J, the $0 to $8 a barrel credit, cannot go below the floor. So in this graphic, which I enjoy very much, is where the man's feet is, the blue arrow. However, there are these other arrows, these other credits that can, in fact, under many circumstances, go below that number all the way down to the so-called basement, to the 0% production tax. And those include the net operating loss credit, which we've talked about some, the GVR eligible per barrel credit, that's the fixed $5 a barrel credit for the new oil, no oil that gets the GVR, as well as the small producer credit and the alternative credit or exploration credit, as it's generally known. All of those can go below the floor. And the intent of the bill is to harden the floor, in colloquial terms, meaning that those credits should also be held to the 4% minimum tax rate.
Mr. Alper, pause. Please. Small producer credits and alternative credits are both going away. Is that true or false?
That is true.
Thank you.
So that would have a very limited short duration impact if they were hardened. Madam Chairman, we're on slide 15. So the current law, and this is just repeating what I've already said, all credits with the exception of the sliding scale per barrel credit can go below the floor, and we're looking to harden it for the four bullet points in the bottom of slide 15, the NOLs, the GVR per barrels, the small producer, and the exploration, the last two of which are relatively small in potential impact and duration. The exploration credits will be gone a year from now, except for Middle Earth. The small producer credits will be phasing out over the next 7 or 8 years, as many as 9 years. So there are really three different policy decisions, three different issues before your committee at this point relating to the minimum tax, and all of them are only North Slope issues because the minimum tax itself only pertains to the North Slope. First is the NOL issue. Should the major producers who have an operating loss credit be able to use those to go below the floor? That's the only section of the bill that we have asked to be retroactive because of the current circumstance where we have a situation this year where we are receiving payments below the minimum tax and are hoping to backfill that. I understand the controversy in that, but that was what's in the governor's original proposal, that this NOL hardening would go back to January. Also the issue of the per barrel credits for new oil, should new oil production be allowed to pay at the zero rate? And then finally, the small producer in exploration, should everyone be forced to pay the minimum tax and not just the major producers, effectively, is what the three decisions on floor hardening are.
Thank you, Mr. Alper. It is now 5:30. So this, I'm looking ahead and I'm seeing that we begin to get into calculations. Perhaps this would be a good breaking point.
Yes.
So thank you very much for being here once again. So we'll stop here and restart again on slide 17. Our next meeting is tomorrow afternoon, Friday, at the usual time, 3:30. We will have invited testimony from industry. We also will have two meetings on Saturday. I misstated the times on Saturday at yesterday's meeting. The 9 a.m. meeting, it's 9 a.m., is the first one. We're going to conclude industry testimony. And then beginning at 2:30, we will hold public testimony. So with that, we will stand adjourned. The time is 5:30.